Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. So glad you're with me this morning. It's November 8th, day after Election Day. Amazing what's happened in a year. I remember the day after the election when Donald Trump became president and economist Paul Krugman said, uh-oh, stock market's going to crash and it will never recover. Well, looks like what a difference a year has made. It's up $5.4 trillion since he took office. Unemployment's at a 17-year low. So there's some good things going on in the economy. And today the results are coming in all over the country from the elections. So we'll have lots to look at and process coming up. I'd like to start with something right out of Psalm. And it's in 52, verse 8, it says, "But I am like an olive tree flourishing in the house of God. I trust in God's unfailing love forever and ever." What a lovely, lovely psalm to start today. We're going to have a great show. We've got Dr. Nathanson coming up. He has written several books. He's done quite a bit of research on misandry, which is a bias towards boys and men in our culture. And he's written several books. His latest one we're going to discuss. I had a chance to sit down with him a little while ago, about a week or so ago. And so I want to have that conversation with you this morning. And then we've got Dr. Kent Kaiser, who will be in studio, and Bill English from BibleandBusiness.com, and Jamar Tisby. And he has renamed his ministry from the Reformed African American Network. And we will unveil that new name coming up in the second hour. So that's how we're going to start our day. So glad you're with us. I hope you've got a nice cup of coffee going, and we will get started together. It's 6 minutes after the hour. Glad you're with us. Be back in a minute. Welcome to the show. We're so glad you're with us today. I've got Dr. Paul Nathanson on our studio line. He has co-authored many books with Dr. Catherine Young on the field of misandry in our culture, Spreading Misandry, the Teaching of Contempt for Men in Popular Culture. The most recent one is it Sanctifying Misandry?
Yes.
That's your most recent book. You've written so many. If you want to get more information about Paul and his books, I think you just Google Paul Nathanson, and you will get to see his library of work. Now, Paul, I'm curious, because in the wake of Hurricane Harvey, and what I mean by that is Harvey Weinstein, once again, the times are changing, aren't they?
Well, actually, they're not changing. The something approaching hysteria over Weinstein's behavior and the thought that underlies this reaction has been going on for a long time. It's not new. It's not even the first of its kind. We had Bill Cosby, we had Bill O'Reilly, we had Bill Clinton, and you can go back for about 20 or 30 years.
I agree with you completely. I mean, I'm thinking more in terms of the way it's now become a hot topic of conversation at the surface of the skin, so to speak.
Yeah. What bothers me about it, first of all, you know, if the allegations are true, then he deserves rebuke and punishment of whatever kind is necessary. But in any case, let's say that he's guilty. But you see, I don't really care about Harvey Weinstein. I care about the way in which people are interpreting this event. Now, I don't blame women for resenting being groped or otherwise made ill at ease. I realize that quid pro quo, which means basically, I'll do you a favor if you do me a favor, is not a sound way to operate a business. The problem here is that we're talking about sexual assault as if the only people who are victims of it are women.
Mm-hmm.
And I disagree with that profoundly. It's not that I think that men are being assaulted in the same way by women. Women have their own ways of intimidating men, and that's what needs to be explored.
Now, when we look at the way in which I mean, the pendulum has really swung from discrimination against women to now really quite a bias against men. And we're seeing that in film and in TV and just about everything. Can you speak more about that?
More importantly, we're seeing it in law.
Oh, yeah. Say more about that.
These movies and romance novels and talk shows and news shows that we discuss in Spreading Misandry, that's just the symptom. There's something underlying that, and it is a kind of prejudice that translates itself into legal change. So that, for example, well, legal and institutional change in universities, for example, which is basically my habitat.
Mm-hmm.
In the States, there are what amount to kangaroo courts in which anybody, usually a man, who is accused of some kind of sexual offense, and it might be anything from rape, which should really be tried in a court of law, to a look that can be misinterpreted or a joke that can be misinterpreted. There's a very extremely wide range of offenses. So these kangaroo courts basically do not give the accused due process.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a problem that, you know, how could we have come to a point in America where due process is discarded in the interest of getting more convictions?
Right.
So it's the presumption of guilt instead of innocence. It's the fact that these people who are accused don't always have the right to get a lawyer. They don't necessarily have a right to see the evidence against them. They don't necessarily have the right even to know who their accuser is. Now, these are big problems, and they're duplicated in the courts. The courts over the past 30 years have changed a great deal in favor of the accusers, who are mainly women. So this is true in divorce and custody suits. It's the same in sexual harassment. It's the same in rape trials. The idea is, in rape in particular, there's a movement called the believer movement, and it's not religious exactly. It's the idea is that people should believe women when they accuse men, even before the case goes to trial. The focus is on believing women.
Mm-hmm.
Women don't lie. Now, you know, this is a democracy, and we have to follow the rule of law. And if the law is biased against the accuser, then we're overturning centuries of legal tradition.
Mm-hmm. You know, Paul, I'm thinking about you on college campuses, and I'm thinking of the boy or the man who maybe awkwardly asks out a girl, and she says no, and all of a sudden now, weeks later, the girl doesn't feel comfortable in the classroom because of that guy who asked her out. And all of a sudden, does the girl start to say, I have a case against this kid?
Well, she would have a case if she could. If she argues, well, he kept on asking me and I kept refusing and therefore he's harassing me.
Okay.
But I think that the interpretation of behavior between men and women is always open to misinterpretation. I mean, that's the way human nature functions. How do you seduce somebody? When is enough enough? It's always subject to interpretation, and it is always going to be an area of conflict. But I think that when you use the law to settle disputes, it's like using an atomic bomb to kill a fly.
Right.
You know, the law is a very blunt instrument, and I think that more and more people are turning to litigation than ever before, and not only in terms of sexual relations, but in terms of anything. The law courts are very busy. Lawyers are making a lot of money because people are turning to the law to settle disputes rather than to either common sense or negotiation or mediation of some kind. The courts, the family courts in particular, very often do favor the woman on the grounds that, and this is another big problem, on the grounds that the mother is the primary caregiver.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, that depends on how you define care. If you define care in strictly emotional terms, then of course an infant is going to turn first for comfort to the parent who gives it food. So, but the problem here is that fatherhood, which has been eroded terribly over the past 30 or 40 years, is considered assistant motherhood at the very best.
Mm-hmm.
There is no sense out there that fathers have a distinctive and necessary role in the family. And that role, I think, is not just to be an extra mother, but it has a distinctive function. And it gets more and more important as the child gets older. As the child leaves the home and enters the larger world, the father is the one who teaches the child to earn respect. Earned respect. Mothers get unconditional love. Fathers get earned respect. And it's a necessary function.
Yeah, that's profound.
So if you have a society, as ours is, that trivializes fathers, which it does, we now have, you know, two mothers are just as good as a mother and a father. Single motherhood is just fine, even by choice. Now, the message that goes out to boys and men is that fathers are unimportant. Now, the real catch is that fatherhood happens to be, the one and only function of men that is distinctive, that's something that mothers don't do or women can't do. It is necessary for the good of the children and therefore of society, and it should therefore be publicly valued. That is what enables men to form a healthy collective identity as men. If you have no such contribution to make, then you cannot have a healthy identity, either personally or collectively.
Paul, I would love to explore that a little bit more. I'm talking to Dr. Paul Nathanson. He's written several books with Dr. Catherine Young on misandry. We're going to take a short break and be right back. More with Dr. Paul Nathanson in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I have Dr. Paul Nathanson on our studio line. He's written a number of books with Dr. Catherine Young in the field of misandry. And Paul, there is a growing problem for sure that our society has about young boys and men creating and sustaining a very healthy identity. It's getting more problematic, isn't it?
It is. Now, if you can think of a source of identity apart from fatherhood, then you tell me and tell the world and you get a Nobel Prize.
Right.
At the moment, women can do and should do everything that men can do except become fathers. And so all of the fact that women are doing all these things either by themselves or with help by government agencies of one kind or another, that's good. I have no problem with that. But if there is no place in the world for men as such, then we're going to have a big, big problem, and we do. And so boys who – now, some what happens is that some men, boys or men, just drop out. The dropout rate from school among boys and men is much, much higher than for women. Other boys or men drop out of life altogether by committing suicide, and that rate is also much, much higher than it is for women.
Mm-hmm.
And if those two stats were reversed, of course, there'd be rioting in the streets. Other men try another solution. They say, look, if I can't have a healthy identity, I'll have a negative one, thank you very much. They are the ones who abandon a society that has no room for them. They're the ones who turn to antisocial behavior, whether it's crime or drugs or simply hostility to women. Big problem here. If you cannot make men have a healthy identity, they're going to act out in one way or another.
Are we differing in opinions as to the needs that young boys and men have, and how do we address those? It seems that in movies and in TV commercials and everything else, it seems like the formula is dad's the dummy, mom's way smart, and the kids are smarter than mom, and then the smartest person in the family is the dog.
Well, yes. I mean, that is a pattern, certainly. When Catherine and I analyzed movies and sitcoms and such, we did find a pattern. It's not the only pattern out there, but it is a strong pattern in which the major male character is evil or inadequate,
mm-hmm.
or both, except there is sometimes a secondary male character who is an honorary woman, either because he's a minority man or a gay man or because he's a convert to feminism. But the male protagonist or antagonist is evil or inadequate. And the woman, of course, the major female character, is always a victim, but one who becomes heroic. Okay, so then it's giving women, they're going to have their cake and eat it too. They're going to be portrayed as victims because that's what feminist ideology proclaims, that they are the archetypal victims in society. But of course, to promote the movement, they're also heroes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Paul, where did we get the jump from father knows best to father knows nothing? Who orchestrated that?
Nobody orchestrated these things. These are just, these are sort of tsunamis of public opinion, conventional wisdom, stereotypes. Okay. They happen. I don't think this was orchestrated by anyone. There's no conspiracy here. Or at least there wasn't. I think that today there are people orchestrating it.
Okay.
And they're the ones that we call ideological feminists, as distinct from egalitarian feminists. Mm-hmm. Egalitarian feminists want equality, and it's just that simple. Ideological feminists, they want equality or even superiority, but the problem is that their way of thinking, the ideological worldview, any ideology, whether political or religious, whether on the right or the left, they all have common characteristics, which we discuss very fully in Spreading Misandry. And the most important one is that they're all dualistic, which is to say, it's about us versus them. We are good, they are evil.
Mm-hmm. How might we go about reclaiming or affirming the inherent dignity of men? And we've got to balance that with the value of women and the way God designed us to work together in harmony.
Well, there is only one way, and it's hard, and we're nowhere near ready for it, and that is what we call intersexual dialogue. And by dialogue, we don't mean just a nice conversation. We don't even mean a debate in which one side wins and the other loses. We mean a conversation in which both sides win. And it must be based on empathy, on the sincere desire, first of all, to have reconciliation. That's one thing. But also the sincere desire to learn something about the other that you don't know or think you already know. So it involves listening carefully. And we've got to get men and women talking in a way in which women actually listen to men, because so far they're not listening.
That's really interesting, Paul. The recurring thread.
And that, by the way, that is based on experience that I've had in interreligious dialogue.
I think the recurring theme I hear in all of this is that we have to start listening to each other. And I don't know if we're doing a very good job of that.
We're not doing it at all.
Yeah. How can we do a better job of this? And what steps do we take? Who initiates it? How do we get this conversation started?
Well, that's a good question. And I honestly don't know the answer, because things have been getting worse, not better, in the past 10 years. I don't know. We could start, I suppose, by having religious and other leaders inviting this kind of thing, making it possible, getting time in schools even for things like conflict resolution. Or it's not going to happen spontaneously.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be this has to be led.
Yes.
And we have to train people to do it. I mean, I'm not even sure that I could do it, but we've got to get people who have skill in group work, getting people together in a way that promotes listening.
Paul, I love your humility, and I love your research and your spirit. Thank you so much for being a guest on the show. And again, we can head over to Amazon.com and check out the library of Dr. Paul Nathanson. He's written several books on misandry. I think there's the count's up to about 4. Is that right, Paul?
Yes, and there are 2 more coming out.
You're a busy man. I appreciate your work. Thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
Have a great day. That was Dr. Paul Nathanson. We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Good morning. It's 29 minutes after the hour. So glad you're with me this morning. If you've just run out of coffee, don't worry. We're going to have bagpipe music in just a few minutes. Dr. Kent Kaiser will be with us in studio. But for now, let's take a little break for news. Be right back. Good morning. 25 minutes till the top of the hour. You know, when we're suffering, it can be hard to see and trust that God is at work. No kidding. Steve Farrar says God is always working on our behalf, even when we can't see it.
Oftentimes, we look on our radar and we're in trouble and we don't see the Lord. We see no possible means. We see no possible means that God could rescue us and save us. But His providence, so many times, is stealth. It doesn't come on your radar. If you just wait, if you just hold on to His faithfulness instead of taking things into your hand, you will see Him. Psalm 50, call on me in the day of trouble. I will rescue you, and you will honor me. In those moments, we have to listen to truth rather than the deception. So anyone in that situation today, that's what I would say. Don't take this into your hands. God knows where you are. He can rescue. He will rescue if you'll call on Him.
Oh boy, the waiting. Can that be a little hard at times? Should we do one big group hug right now? It's kind of hard sometimes, isn't it, to wait. But let's trust God is working behind the scenes, and He is there for us. We'll take a short break. Kent Kaiser is in studio. Get ready for the bagpipe music, and then we'll have some lively discussion about some of the top news stories of the day. Be back in a minute.
Frequently we hear, all politicians are liars, or throw the bums out, all of them. I strongly disagree. This is Jim Garlow. Politics is not a dirty word. It's a calling to be highly respected. Then why such a negative view? Could it be because government is failing to be what a government is supposed to be? The primary purpose of government is to protect its citizens, to do so by restraining evil. Isaiah said it centuries ago, "For the Lord is our judge, our lawgiver, our king. It is He who will save us." So are we advocating a theocracy where religious rulers govern based on what God has spoken? No. To affirm God's role in government is not to call for some type of a theocracy. Our goal is for our government to protect our God-given rights. Stay well-versed in these issues at jimgarlow.com. Be prepared to live out your faith.
Somehow that clears out my sinuses. I don't know why and how, but it does. 24 minutes until the top of the hour. That music means Dr. Kent Kaiser is in studio. Always love having him come in on Wednesdays. Good morning, Kent.
Good morning.
So tax reform is underway, and one of the moves the GOP is trying to do is repeal the Johnson Amendment.
Yeah, and we talked about this before the election.
And Let's remind listeners what it is.
I know, I've tweeted about it since then. Like, Mr. President, when are we going to get the repeal of the Johnson Amendment? The Johnson Amendment is named after the former President Lyndon Johnson, and it was named with his name when he was a senator. So this is an old amendment on that's been attached to, you know, our laws ever since. But the Johnson Amendment prohibits nonprofits and thus churches and pastors from endorsing particular political candidates and parties if they are to keep their nonprofit status. Mm-hmm. And people, listeners might know that it seems pastors are super, super cautious about even dipping their toe into politics, even when it comes to issues, let alone candidates, because they fear so much that the mm-hmm. government's going to come down and revoke their nonprofit status, which means that all of their donations would have to be taxed and so on. And so this would be just, I think, a great move. It would remove that wet blanket, if you will, that exists over, you know, religion when it comes to talking about political issues. I mean, again, I don't know if I don't really know if many pastors are actually going to endorse candidates from the pulpit. You know, that's kind of the image that we always have. But I think that pastors might feel emboldened to start talking more frankly about some of the ballot questions and some of the issues that come out in an election, and then people can draw their conclusions maybe as to who to vote for. Right now, I just think that people are so afraid of even talking politics in church that that it just doesn't happen. Now, the one thing I would say, though, you know, there's one caution I might have with the repeal of the Johnson Amendment, and that is once it happens, and I think it will happen here with tax reform, once it happens, my fear is that the liberal churches will be like, you know, aggressive then about endorsing candidates and getting involved in politics, whilst the conservative churches might be literally conservative about their approach to the Johnson Amendment and or their newfound ability to endorse candidates from the pulpit and to talk about issues from the pulpit. And if that's happened, that obviously is really unfortunate. But President Trump said all during the campaign that he was in favor of the repeal of the Johnson Amendment. So if only the Senate and the House can just pass this, it is sure to be signed by President Trump.
Mm-hmm. Now, Kent, Johnson's intention to target churches was never even on his radar when this thing came about.
No, it was for nonprofits, and the idea was that charitable money would not go toward campaigning. And so there are many nonprofits, obviously, who are, you know, under the Johnson Amendment. I mean, I've worked at some which are public policy nonprofits, and there's where it gets really kind of – you're walking a fine line sometimes. Yeah. You know, you're talking about issues that might be on the ballot or issues that candidates are talking about. And, of course, the nonprofits I've worked for have been really conservative ones. And so sometimes you might be accused of being partisan, even though you're not. You're just talking about issues. But this would lift that burden of having to be super careful about how you talk about issues. And all of a sudden you might be able to say, and by the way, these candidates support our organization's stand on these issues. And personally, I think that'd be a good thing. It just brings openness to the whole political communication process when interest groups can say, these are the candidates that we support.
Mm-hmm. All right, Kent, a little meanness is always present in the media, more so than ever lately. Now, there's been some body shaming with White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders. What do you make of that?
She is awesome, by the way. I think she's one of the best spokespeople that's ever been in the White House. But she's a mother, a soccer mom. She's, you know, she's kind of a normal-sized person, I would say, if you just look around. Maybe a few extra pounds on her, like a lot of us, I suppose. And it was interesting to see that an L.A. Times columnist fat shamed her, and it was up only very briefly, but he referred to her as a chunky soccer mom. Well, she is a soccer mom, you know, but he referred to her as that and also made fun of her Southern accent. And you just kind of picture what would have happened if this were the Obama administration and some conservative publication had done something like that. It would have been just, you would have heard about it for days and days and days. Well, the L.A. Times, the opinion columns, he did apologize, and they did pull it down pretty quickly after they got some flack from conservatives for fat-shaming Sarah Huckabee Sanders. But it's just amazing how they put it in print in the first place. There's so many times when you think, you know, okay, you might think something, but keep it to yourself. But they're so liberal that all of their, you know, all those little stoplights or yield signs that should normally be in their brain, they just run through them because in their quest to be as liberal as possible. And so all the rules of proper society kind of go out the window because they're just so blind to, you know, what propriety would dictate they should or should not say.
Well, Kent, the speed at which articles get into publications and blogs and papers, probably a different procedure today than there was 10, 15, 20 years ago, even when you would submit your report to the editor's desk and it would get reviewed and then it would go to the printing press and the paper would come out the next day. And I don't know, do the reporters just go online and put their report on? And
I don't even know how it actually works.
I don't either.
It does seem like
a couple of smart guys like us, and we didn't even know how that works.
But, I mean, it doesn't excuse it. This is the thing. I mean, a person shouldn't even think that way. The person shouldn't even think like, I can call Sarah Huckabee Sanders a chunky soccer mom. That's just, who could even write or think that way, you know, to begin with in order to write it down?
Right.
It's insane to think that somebody actually has these thoughts and commits them to paper, or in this case, of course, to the computer. People might have a sort of a reaction. They maybe think it's funny or something. I don't know what.
Sure.
And then quick, they type it out. But at some point, shouldn't there be a stoplight or at least a yield sign in their head that says, okay, wait a minute, maybe that's not the way I should put this, or maybe I should take that line out altogether. I mean, I once had a writing professor who told our class, you know, find the funniest line when we were writing something funny. Find the funniest line and delete it because it's not as funny as you think it is. You know, and I think there's something to that. If this guy thought that was a funny line, you should have just taken it out.
Yeah. Well, it's I always admire Sarah's response to just about everything because she is really tough and she's no nonsense and.
Yeah, she's very smooth.
Everything kind of rolls off her.
It really does. So. She's been involved with politics since she was a little kid because her dad, Mike Huckabee, was governor of Arkansas. And she talks about how the fun things for her was to hang out with her dad and to go to parades and to go to all the public events that he was campaigning at. And that she had a little desk in his office like while he was campaigning. And even while he was governor, she had a little desk. You can picture her, you know, really being part of the political establishment, and yet she's from a part of the political establishment that, of course, we as conservatives really enjoy. And so she knows how to deal with the liberal political establishment in a really adept way.
Mm-hmm. Kent, let me take a little break. When we come back, let's talk about what's going on in Lebanon and Saudi Arabia and jump into some of those subjects. It's 15 minutes until the top of the hour. So glad you're with me this morning. I will be right back. Minutes until the top of the hour. I have Dr. Kent Kaiser in studio. We talk a little bit about everything, don't we, Kent?
We really do.
All right. Big resignation of Lebanese Prime Minister Saeed Hariri. Hariri, yeah. That's turning things a little chaotic over there.
Well, it's interesting to see what's going on here in Lebanon, which is, of course, right next to Israel. There has been a lot of terrorist activity by the terrorist organization Hezbollah. The United States listed that as a terrorist organization back during the Clinton administration. So it's been a long time that we've, in a sense, been fighting Hezbollah, as has Israel. Usually the attacks are against Israel and against Christians and so on. And so the prime minister of Lebanon, Saad Hariri, was traveling to Saudi Arabia and actually announced his resignation from there because he felt like there were threats to his life that that were imminent. And so here he is not even in his own country when he announced his resignation. And part of this was a plan, I guess, from on the part of Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has started to take a pretty aggressive stance against Hezbollah. So in other words, fighting for U.S. interests. I think that a lot of this has to do with the sort of friendship, I guess you'd say, the relationship that President Trump has with the Saudi leaders. And particularly, there's a new crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. He was appointed last June, who's been really aggressive at helping to fight corruption and to help fight Hezbollah and also Iran. And Iran is really what's behind Hezbollah. And so you can imagine you've got these two big countries, big powerful countries, Saudi Arabia and Iran, who are at odds in the Middle East. Of course, we're on Saudi Arabia's side. And finally, we've got, and this has really taken place since President Trump visited Saudi Arabia. People might remember that was his first trip abroad, that he visited Saudi Arabia and also Israel and so on. But since that trip, the Saudi Arabia government has really taken a harder stance against Iran. And I think that they fear that Iran could become, you know, too powerful in the region. And Saudi Arabia, of course, wants to be that power player in that region. So this is helpful to the United States that Saudi Arabia is finally getting into the game or really getting into the game. They've been in for a while, but really getting into the game and helping to quell of Iran's bad behavior and Hezbollah, which they've supported.
So just remind me again why there's been so many people arrested, like 11 princes, a prominent billionaire, and all other kinds of current and former ministers? Why are they?
Well, I think there's a lot of stuff that we don't necessarily know about, but apparently a lot of corruption, a lot of bribery, okay. And so on going on. And people should understand that the Saudi family includes thousands of people, and they've been rooting out the bad apples lately, and so hundreds have been arrested, and I think that they're really trying to clean up their government. I think that Saudi Arabia is really trying to be a much more modern nation. I mean, and that's part of it, is like you eliminate corruption. If you have a modern country, that's one of the things you do. And so some of this has an impact on the United States because, I mean, some of this corruption is bad for the economy globally.
Mm-hmm.
And President Trump even tweeted last week, you know, he's encouraging them now to bring one of their companies to the New York Stock Exchange, and it's the Saudi government's oil interests, and that would be a huge boon to our economy. And I think that what's happening here, just overall, Saudi Arabia is trying to sort of up its game and become part of the modern world, and you could see that being contrasted then with much of the rest of the Middle East, especially like Iran, which is clearly being left behind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think that Saudi Arabia really enjoys the idea of being the premier country in the Middle East and being the most dominant, being the most worldly and most connected. And, you know, I think all part of that is being connected to the West and being particularly connected to the United States and having a good relationship with the United States.
Mm-hmm. Kent, this next story I'd like to ask you about, I should almost recuse myself because this is a story originates from my actual high school. And I'm talking about an English course at a public school in Minnesota that's aimed at eradicating white privilege. Now, I want you to put this in context for us and help us to understand what this story is all about. It's actually made national news.
So you were one of these white, you're one of these really privileged white kids who went to Edina, I guess.
Yes.
Well, the kids at Edina have been.
You keep talking. I'm going to have a piece of cake and some coffee right now.
Well, yeah. Well, the kids in Edina have been required to take this English course that turns out to be a lot of sort of indoctrination, and it's aimed at eradicating white privilege, supposedly. And what it winds up being is that many of these kids are made to feel inferior and, in fact, to feel bad about themselves because the curriculum talks about white people being oppressors of non-white people. And I mean, these are poor kids. I mean, these kids haven't, I mean, these are, they haven't oppressed anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they're being made to feel like their own identity is negative.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, some people found out about it and have been starting to make an issue about it. And it's interesting. There's a black teacher there in Edina who actually is standing up for the white kids. He's saying he takes issue with this curriculum, saying that the curriculum actually makes it seem like black kids are less able to learn than white kids, which is also objectionable. So this seems to be objectionable all around from the perspective of white kids, from the black kids, whatever. It's just remarkable that, again, here we have these sort of blinders on these liberal bureaucrats in the education establishment who come along, and I'm sure they have good intentions or something, but you know, they institute these kinds of curriculum and policies that, again, like a normal person would look at these and go, you know what, this just doesn't seem right.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, this particular school district is getting called out on it. Now, I'm certain that this is not the only school district in the country that's doing this. It's just that this one conservative organization, Center of the American Experiment, here in Minnesota, found out about this particular curriculum. I think parents just need to be, wherever you are, I think as a parent, you have to really pay attention to what is the curriculum that your kids are being forced to consume when they go to the public schools. Because if you don't police it, who's gonna? You know that there's probably not very many conservative teachers in your school district. And even if there were, are they really going to speak up against this liberal establishment? Probably not.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they all want to get their tenure and keep their jobs and just keep their heads down. And so unfortunately, you have things like this come up, and it's only by, oh my goodness, just by sheer, you know, Providence or whatever, that that somebody finds out what's going on and takes issue with it.
Well, I found it interesting that, for example, they've gone from 5th to 29th in reading proficiency between 2014 and 2017.
Which is a big drop. And you know, so this curriculum might be, you know, might be helping the liberal agenda, but it's not helping actual skills.
Yeah, I think when I was there in high school, I mean, the proficiency was even higher because I'd done real good with book learning.
I'm sure you did.
When I was there.
My guess is that as soon as you graduated, they probably bumped right up to number one.
I think they did, Kent. This is why I bring you in, for your keen observations and careful analysis. It is interesting how this becomes part of the conversation. Apparently, one of the teachers has a principal designers of the course shared a more candid version in a book written for teachers called More Courageous Conversations About Race. I guess that's starting to take over, isn't it?
It kind of is.
Yeah. Well, Kent, thanks so much for coming in studio. I always love seeing you on Wednesday, and have a great day.
Thanks for having me in.
You bet. It is 3 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a short break, and then look forward to hour two. We have Bill English coming up at about 8 minutes after the hour. Be back in a minute. Thank you very much to Dr. Kent Kaiser and also Dr. Paul Nathanson. What a great first hour. We've got a great second hour coming up with Bill English from BibleandBusiness.com. And then Jamar Tisby, you may remember him from the Reformed African American Network. Well, they've changed their name. We'll unveil that in the second hour and have a nice conversation with him. So that's how we're getting our day started. Fire up another cup of coffee, hang in there with me, and get ready for work or school or whatever. Be back in a minute. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.